Society Library. My name is Carol Malone. I'm chair of the Board of Trustees, and it's an enormous pleasure to introduce our two speakers this evening, Susanna Lessard and Betsy Barlow Rogers, who we know very well because her husband Ted, who's here tonight, is one of our trustees. Before I begin, could I remind you to turn off your cell phones? And I'd also like to announce that we're selling books outside this room in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery, and both Susanna and Betsy will be signing them if you care to buy them tonight. Ms. Lessard is the best-selling author of The Architect of Desire, Beauty and Danger in the Stanford White Family, a bestseller and a New York Times notable book. Susanna was a founding editor of The Washington Monthly and a staff writer of The New Yorker for 20 years, commenting on current events and discussing the city and its history. She's a recipient of the Whiting Award, the Lucas Awards, and has received fellowships from the Woodrow Wilson Center, International Scholars, and George Washington University. The Washington Monthly, which she helped to found 50 years ago, continues to provide independent and incisive coverage of topical political events. The Architect of Desire, part social history and part memoir, was a book in which Ms. Lessard describes the shadows cast by the life of architect Stanford White, her great-grandfather. Her current work of nonfiction, which she will talk about tonight, The Absent Hand, Reimagining Our American Landscape, has been recently described by Publishers Weekly as an elegant series of essays in which the author explores the American landscape as a metaphor for recent shifts in our national consciousness. Now, landscape is a word which comes immediately to mind whenever we think of Betsy Barlow Rogers. Betsy is the president for the Foundation of Landscape Studies, a native of San Antonio, Texas. She earned her BA degree from Wellesley College and an MA from Yale University in city planning. As many of you know, in 1979, she was appointed Central Park Administrator in the following year in order to bring citizen support to the restoration and management renewal of Central Park. She initiated the Central Park Conservancy, the nation's first public-private park partnership, which she led until 1996. And since that time, she's done so much. She's created the Garden History and Landscape Curriculum at Bard Graduate Center and the Foundation for Landscape Studies. Betsy's the author of 8 books, many of which delve into the history of the green spaces of our city from the days when it was primeval forest until the present. Betsy has received so many medals, among them the Rockefeller Foundation's Jane Jacobs Medal for Lifetime Achievement, the Preservation League of New York State's Pillar of New York Award, and the New York Botanical Gardens' Rarely Conferred Gold Medal. And as I said in my introduction to Betsy's talk last year, and I hope I won't bore those of you who were here then, she always puts me in mind of the girl in the story by the Edwardian short story author Saki, also known as H.H. Monroe, in which a little girl who wins so many medals that when she goes out for a walk in the park, her medals clink together and she's swallowed by a tiger. He wanted to eat them. As I mentioned, Betsy is married to Ted Rogers, our library trustee, and we're so grateful to Betsy and to Ted for their support of the library, especially for their support of our City Readers program, in which our 18th century and 19th century original charging ledgers have been put online, and you can read them by going to our website, and you can read which of our founding fathers was taking out what book in what month and what year. And that way you can see if they were reading the same thing at the same time. Before we start, I have for Susanna and for Betsy a question with which to begin our talk tonight. And that question is, how do each of you define landscape? So please join me in welcoming Susanna Lessard and Betsy Barlow Rogers.
I'm going to start. I think you should hold on, because they can't, they're in. I was kind of you to say I received the awards. It's really like I wear a badge that says something for people who love the park so much, and they're so glad that the park did experience a renaissance and came back from what I call my recent near death. And so when I gave that speech for a medal I got at Notre Dame School of Architecture, a prize, the Foundation for Landscape Studies, I gave a speech, and here is how I started it. When we speak of a sense of place, what does this mean? What is it exactly that we sense? How indeed do we sense a place, its nature, its character, its genius, and how can we make sense of that which we perceive with our senses? Are we able to articulate certain inherent attributes of places? From these questions spring others. How does geography, topography, climate, education, natural resources confer collective meaning on place? There is something intangible and atmospheric that one can sense in the earth and sky, mountains, plains, oceans, rivers, vegetation. These geographical features are primary determinants of place consciousness. Climate, too, is a principal source of place impression. Its modulation by technological means are minutely local, constituting only small atmospheric modifications within a macro environment that is much grander, less predictable, and more difficult to control, as we well know in this era of climate change. The duration and intensity of summer and winter, the character of vegetation, the levels of precipitation, these environmental givens form a vocabulary of seasonality that is a crucial part of our sense of place, which is why the weather is always crucial. And here is how I end my talk. And we say that time is another important factor in our understanding of place. We need to recognize that only geographical coordinates persist and the place is eternally mutating. The making and remaking of cities through addition, subtraction, or renovation of buildings, roads, bridges, parks, and other forms of infrastructure is the province of the urban planner, architect, and landscape designer. Unfortunately, the results of indifference to place are all around us. Anywhere is becoming increasingly, like everywhere else, an outcome of consumer capitalism in which brand and market are commonly used as verbs. And corporately run fast food operations, hotels, stores, and service businesses create a ubiquitous sameness in which place has become delocalized and is nothing more than what is standard and familiar. I have three comments of this. If anyone wants to be told. Now, Suki, you have something to say about your concept of place, which is so brilliantly, I say philosophical and cogent.
Well, my sense of landscape comes purely from myself and as a writer and as an observer. But it originated, as does so with so many of us, in childhood. There really was, close on, a pretty mystical component to that that grew into what I can see in retrospect was romanticism later. And throughout all that, throughout my life, I would say landscape was always very important to me. If I were writing a piece, if there was a way to start with place, I would. But when in the 90s I sensed that the meaning of place had changed, and not necessarily when it had physically changed, that places that were actually the same as they had been and loved didn't really mean the same thing, and I couldn't put my figure on it. I really needed to probe that. And I did that by traveling, going to a lot of places, digging down, asking questions, what really is going on here. And in the course of doing that, I had to challenge all of my preconceptions about what landscape was, including these landscapes you're describing, which I had always thought of just destroyers of landscape, not as even landscapes themselves. But this was a whole new level. And as I did this, one of the things I resisted was the economic interpretation. And the reason for that was that it seemed too reductive. It was powerful, it was important, but it left too much out. Finally, in the end, I did have to adopt that. So the reason is I found, and I use the word work instead of economics because it's a more humanistic word. Landscape is nothing if not humanistic. So I'm going to read just a short section here in response to Betsy's reading. We have a call and response here. Yeah, it's a conversation of reading. Landscape is what arises from the hand of work as we make our living on the planet and our relation to one another as we do so. The hand of work creates in terrain a kind of syntax, an arrangement of interrelating parts, a composition that has a human meaning that is always in part beyond words. Landscape is the work of art that results from this collaboration between man and that which has been provided, the raw environment, something that comes from beyond us. There is always in landscape the inexplicable shock, the wonder of our appearance here to begin with. In the first place, landscape always incorporates shifting layers of human meaning, some purely personal, sometimes strangely close to the hidden springs of personhood, some familial or communal, some cultural or regional, but always, ultimately to my mind, even when landscape invites us to solitude, it recalls our profound social connectedness, a sense of our lives together. The greatest power of landscape is that in expressing our collaboration with the physical world, and in that with each other, it becomes the armature of our common interior life, our most social dimension. This is the ultimate, most profound value of landscape to me.
Now, do you all see why I'm suffering a great attack of writer's envy? In an email, you suggested this as another topic for us to discuss. Landscapes, this is what you said, landscapes hold history for us, but our interpretations of history change. And that brought me to think, because I just written this, the next letter from the editor of the Foundation for Landscape Studies Journal, Sightlines. This is the last issue. The new issue's coming up. I put three copies. I put them out there. So three lucky people will get the last issue. And the new issue is about landscapes, rewriting the narratives of history in the landscape. Today, commemoration in the form of art, architecture, landscape design, and place preservation lies in the balance. Sites with iconic status generate both controversy and fierce protection. These include representations recollecting literary giants, royal personages, political leaders, military heroes, religious figures, and Such sites are often interpreted idealistically by the creators and curators for the purpose of inspiring reverence and admiration in those who visit them. On the other hand, some monuments and historic landmarks have come to be reviled as symbols of ethnic and other kinds of discrimination. In either case, a more objective narrative of place demands consideration, debate, and consequent reinterpretation. Now, Suki can tell us about the terrific chapter on Gettysburg.
Well, all landscapes that have been around for a while hold historic memory for us. That's one of the things that landscape does very well, and it can hold it way past the time of that history. But as we see, one way of sort of looking at interpretations very clearly is to look at intentionally preserved landscapes and how we deal with those. So when the Park Service, our United States Park Service, took over the Civil War battlefields, which was at the beginning of the century, before the sort of impromptu groups were preserving them, and they were our first preserved landscapes, they left out slavery in the curatorial treatment. What rangers said, what plaques were, what displays were, they just left it out. Civil War battlefields, that's what they did. I'm going to read here a little from the chapter in my book on Gettysburg. The rationale offered in the 1990s, when the policy was finally challenged, was that the mandate of the service was to offer recreation and enjoyment. Maybe some education, but not to upset people. The presentation should be patriotic, pleasurable, suitable for families. You wanted people to be comfortable, to have a good time. That ruled out what is probably still our most disturbing, divisive subject. Curated in this tactful way, the battlefields, like the war overall, became mythical. Gettysburg especially is one of the most popular of our historical sites, a great destination for families. It and other seemingly remembering landscapes, so pent up with forgetting, over time took on a meaning that seems almost independent of their actual historic significance. Rather than conjuring scenes of horror, and Gettysburg, 50,000 men died, it's equal to our U.S. casualties in Vietnam. It was one of the first instances of industrial warfare, not quaint at all. Much less recalling for us the crack in our national foundation that was slavery, the battlefield somehow became touchstones of the American soul. They, not sites of Native American civilizations or of colonial settlements or of the Revolution, are the closest we come to a past about which we have mystical feelings. Does not the roll call of our Civil War battlefields, Manassas, Antietam, Bull Run, Chancellorsville, Shiloh, trace directly into our complicated American place love, mixing faith with noble heroism? It's as if the nobility of the cause of ending slavery and the heroism of the sacrifice of life to do that were lifted out of their circumstances and blended into an intoxicating mixture of tragedy and innocence, extracted completely from its historical origins. Then the sites themselves became permeated with that peculiar intoxicating delight. At Gettysburg, it occurred to me that our infatuation with the Civil War has masked an awareness of bottled up pain, a need to know it and face it in all its complications eventually. What else could explain our underlying obsession with this piece of our history? I began to think that for all its obscuring functions, our romance with the war ultimately served a wish to truly meet ourselves when we were ready. Seen that way, the romance of the Civil War is not, after all, an invasive fantasy, but a preservative force that in the most constructive sense. Is not knowing ourselves as fully as possible the sacred purpose of all kinds of preservation. It's not landscape itself, whether purposefully preserved or merely lasting beyond its time, also ultimately most precious to us, not as an elegiac reminder of the past, but as a mirror of ourselves, then and now, in all our complicated humanity. If we are not yet hungry for the knowledge a place holds, well then, the place will let us preserve that gift in fantasies until we really need it. I propose this not as a way of urging us to wallow in the evil embedded in our history, but to understand ourselves in our full complexity, to have a knowledge of ourselves that is the equal of the predicaments we have created. This attitude toward the past is inherently forward-looking, is optimistic. It is different from the uncovering of hitherto hidden historical crimes, important as that is. This way of looking back is a first step in making the gift of the past we need now accessible. The fields at Gettysburg are an especially good place to begin to look for it, but the gift is everywhere around us, especially in our older landscapes. Paradoxically, those least changed.
Wow. I think that we wanted to say something about city planning. I'll pick up here in Suki's book. This is what she says. Moses, this is, you know who, Robert Moses. was an expert politician, but also a trained urban planner whose ideas reflected the planning mindset of the time, one impervious to aesthetics. The spirit of the City Beautiful movement of the late 19th century, which had produced lovely features along Beaux-Arts lines, such as Washington Square Arch, or Olmstedian inspirations like Central Park, was long forgotten as planning became a profession associated with engineering, both structural and social. The efficiency of the automobile was a dominant concern, separating seedy parts of cities from forward-looking economic development sites was another. It was planners, not politicians, who routed early interstates into the hearts of cities across the nation. But to be fair, you have to remember that from the 19th century onward, Olmsted's parks and the City Beautiful movement, notwithstanding, the structure and feeling of people of a humanist inclination deplored the gigantic industrial city as a social horror. Though decline set in fairly early in the 20th century and was accelerating in the 1960s, the idea that cities were vulnerable, precious, and in need of curatorial attention just wasn't current. Get people out into the green country in cars, that was the common sense of planning in Moses' time, had been for a long time, and indeed was the purpose of parkways. Now I want to say something along those lines. And as it happens, new book. It's terrible to have the pleasure of talking about this before, but I'm on the beach just briefly. Because I think, of course, the planning in America starts right over there with the creation of Central Park. And I also want to say that it is citizens really who created the park. Government followed, but citizens really created the park's movement. And Centurions Noel, William Cullen Bryant, in 1844, this poet and newspaper editor encouraged the establishment of a kind of park that would satisfy the ambition of civic-minded New Yorkers who wished their burgeoning metropolis to emulate great European cities in this regard. Yet, unlike the old world parks, which had their origins as the domains of kings and princes, and in spite of the fact that some proponents were initially uneasy over the proposed admission of the Holy Alloy, the New York Park was intended to be a people's park for all classes of society. In promoting this democratic objective, Bryant suggested that the forested area known as Jones Wood, 140-acre parcel bounded by 66 and 75th Street between 3rd Avenue and the East River, would make an ideal location. I won't go into that, you know that. Central, they wanted to save that for the commercial interest of building up of the piers along the East River as well as the Hudson. Central Park, which is named so because it's around the Central Reservoir, which was, we won't go in, I can keep being Professor Rogers, that's the statement, but the citizens on the heels of Bryant's advocacy after returning from a trip to England in 1850, Hudson River Valley nurseryman turned landscape designer Andrew Jackson Downing also proposed the creation of a public park worthy of the citizenry of the metropolis in the making. In his magazine, The Horticulturist, Downing touched the tender nerve of his American readers' cultural inferiority complex with these words. What are called parks in New York are not even apologies for the thing. They are only squares and patterns. A year later, outspoken newspaper editor, politician, and social reformer Horace Greeley announced in his New York Tribune, the parks, squares, and public gardens of London beat us clear out of sight. So, I'm going to read you now the first paragraph of chapter 5. It says here, because I really want you to know how this park came to be. And it was through a design competition, and Calvert Box was the partner of Andy Jackson Downing, who might have designed Central Park had he not died in a steamboat accident and been drowned in the Hudson River. And so Box came to New York and set up his architectural, can you hear me?
No, not really, no.
And he set up his architectural practice here in New York. And he knew that this person, Frederick Law Olmsted, who was a writer, he was not any landscape, they didn't even have the term landscape architect. Box and Olmsted invented it only after they had begun to work on Central Park and needed a title for who they were as professionals. So here is Box, and the design competition is announced, and he asked this writer, Frederick Law Olmsted, who had traveled in England and written about the great English estates and gardens, and he had traveled in the American South on the eve of the Civil War, and he was writing not as an abolitionist, but as a proponent of the Free Soil Party, that slavery was diseconomical, embedded in those dispatches, which went to the New York Evening Times, and then collected in his books, Slavery in the Seaboard Slave States, Journey to Texas, Journey in the Backcountry, are the most wonderful descriptions of scenery. Fox must have known Olmsted had the eye. And so what led British architect Calvert Box to propose collaboration with Olmsted in preparing a submission in the design competition of Central Park in 1850 can only be surmised. His own most important credential was the knowledge of landscape design he'd acquired from Andrew Jackson Downing, recruited him in 1851 as his architectural collaborator on plans for what were then known as rural villas on grounds he was laying out for the gentry who were purchasing old farms in the Hudson River Valley and converting them into estates. That occupation had ended with Downing Smith in 1852, after which Fox moved to New York with the notion of setting up an independent architectural practice. As I listened, two important reasons why Fox may have approached Olmsted were that he lacked Olmsted's social and professional connections and the latter's experience as a well-known writer. Also, in Olmsted's favor was the fact that his new job as on-site superintendent of clearing operations gave him intimate knowledge of the future park's terrain. However, perhaps even more important was what Fox must have perceived as Olmsted's predisposition for viewing landscape with the eyes of a latter-day romantic, a qualification that may not have seemed as far-fetched then as it might have. You should think about the romantic landscape for sure.
Well, actually, you know, this I'm interested in our current landscape today, and just of which we really must become stewards at this point because of various elements. But what we see in this story is culture pushing back. We see the hand of work creating the industrial city and this powerhouse, economic powerhouse that required this enormous size. And the grid and huge populations, but was inhumane in so many regards. And then people pushed back to civilize it. That's what the creation of Central Park is. It's culture pushing back and gaining and civilizing the new age. Industrial age was the first time we saw monumental, destructive, created, but also destructive growth. And therefore, what are you saying? You're not really sure. It's distorting.
It's
short. Wait, how's that? Okay, so I'm going to keep going. Tell me if it's doing something horrible. Okay, so they came up. Now, what that counter push in landscape. And I always think landscape is about everything. It's not just, that's really what attracted me as a subject. It's certainly about the political situation then and now. But they came up with a profoundly aesthetic form that took care of human needs that are disregarded by the market. And society pushed back in other ways as well, creating the all the philanthropic work, museums, libraries, orchestras, culture, all that was protected from the raw energy of the market. And that doesn't create landscape, but that's what we have there. What we have too that's very interesting to me is this romantic. This landscape is exactly the opposite of what raw industrialism is, but it's factories and crowds and tenements and all that. It is the complete opposite, and yet it is determined by that in being the opposite. And that's just the whole industrial age was like that, and the romanticism about the Civil War is similar. We push back with romantic things then. I don't think we can now. But I think that it's time to move to now. Well, move to the new metropolis as it was then, also. We continue to deal with that, right? Over to you.
Yeah, she lifts up one of her books. This is like magnum opus. It's called Landscape Design, Cultural and Architectural History. Here is what I say. This chapter and the section of the chapter, which is called The Exploding Metropolis. As walled cities become problems of the past, after the formation of nation states, and this industrial technology provided means of transportation that effectively shrank distance, making it possible to commute between widely separated places of work and home. The spatial envelope of cities became greatly enlarged. In spite of a lingering Jeffersonian bias in favor of a predominantly agrarian destiny for America, manufacturing and commerce were breeding increasingly large urban populations, and this fostered an unprecedented growth in the size of cities. Public sanitation victories through the kind of engineering technology represented by the New York Croton Aqueduct System and other industrial age improvements, such as smooth macadam roadbeds instead of cobblestone paving, made large cities more livable than before. But they still presented many difficulties for their inhabitants, the most notable being deprivation of contact with nature. As the countryside became increasingly distant from the city, Olmsted and Vox felt that a single park's role as a civilizing influence, ameliorating the noise and hectic pace of the metropolis, was still somewhat limited. They envisioned the carriage drives within parks being extended to become parkways. They envisioned extending them to be parkways, tree canopy, transportation corridors connected to other parks, the whole forming a new framework superimposed over the grid, a green skeleton guiding the city's expansion. They saw more of the roadway layout necessarily dictated the pattern of urban growth, with residential development of a more elegant nature being spawned by a circulation system that segregated private estates from commercial through traffic. In their grasp of the city as an evolving regional organism, they were the country's first urban planners. Finally, I want to say this about skipping over to the parkways. 200-foot wide landscape boulevards now lined with handsome residences remain a much appreciated amenity. If you've been to Buffalo, you've seen the wonderful parkways connecting them. They have the commission to plan Buffalo on Staten Island. So you see the parkways there. In 1874, on land contiguous to Delaware Park, Olmsted prepared a plan for Parkside, the city's first residential suburb, which had curving streets lined with trees and large lots for fine homes with landscape grounds. We don't have time to talk about Olmsted, the design for Riverside, Illinois, outside of Chicago, you're nodding your head, and also how modern planners back in the, let's say, the 20s, or even earlier with Forest Hills Gardens, and then also Sunnyside in Queens, and Radburn, New Jersey, how these were the first suburbs designed for the motor age, and they had communal green space, and the cars were on the back side, the alley side. I mean, it's really wonderful examples of an attempt to actually plan for the motor age. And so what happened?
So really, again, that tells us what happened last time. And I think we are going through a revolution as big as the one from agrarian to industrial, just if not more radical. So what is the new republic, just sticking with landscape on that very huge subject, what is the new metropolis today? What are we looking at today? And this is what my book is about. Like, what is happening? What does the place mean? It doesn't seem to mean what it once did. And so I just will go back, you know, I sense this as a place lover on Bergen Street in Brooklyn, which I moved to just sort of at the last minute when you could still think you were moving to a place that was as it had long been. It probably, you know, I thought that in the 90s. I hadn't really been to Brooklyn much. You could still be a Manhattanite and not been to Brooklyn much. And I was absolutely charmed by this place, and but felt there, it was like invasion of the body snatchers, something. It just wasn't what it seemed to be. And it was a serious intimation that sent me out to many, many different places to figure out what the heck is going on, what is this? And I would dig down in Kentucky Bluegrass, in inner city Youngstown, in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. I'd go to diverse places and ask, what is this place really? And this is where, everywhere where I dug down, what I would see was the global economy facilitated by electronic communication to find that place. Didn't matter what it looked like. It might look like farmland. It might look like all sorts of different things. Or it might look totally new. But it didn't matter. And that was where I really had to knuckle under to the importance of work and came around to seeing the importance of this new generation of technological tools. And this is the thing about them, that where all our tools since time immemorial have extended physical strength, and in that designed landscape, these extended the power of mind. And mind the mind is not a physical thing, and that's as of course we have brains, but mind work and extending the powers of mind doesn't have physical requirements. It doesn't create landscape. If we have bodies, we've got to be somewhere. But it doesn't have this whole accompanying expression and art-making thing that has been with us for time immemorial. And so this is where I shifted and developed my definition, but also where I went into the very contemporary landscape of our time, the placelessness kind of landscape that what we call placeless. That's almost cliche at this point that we say that about it, because it's the same wherever you go. In fact, more and more even around the world, wherever you go, it's the same. And so this is what I came to struggle with. And was this just another expansion of the metropolis? It didn't seem so. It didn't seem like you could define it that way, the way they did the last time around, because it's so extremely decentered. In some cases, the city's just a hole in the donut. In other cases, there really isn't a donut. It's a scattering. It is so disparate. You've got townhouses next to a dairy farm. You've got mirror glass from offices in the woods. And you've got things all around. The fact is, work can be done anywhere. And it can be done in the old fossils of the previous age, as we well know. It can be done in, as a matter of fact, it can be done in bed or in a hammock. I mean, it just can be done absolutely anywhere. So when people need to build now, because people don't have to be somewhere to do something, it doesn't matter what they do. It just can be any old thing, really. And that's what we got out there. Its incoherence, however, is meaningful. That's what I came around to. Before, I would just try to avoid this, if possible. But the incoherence of that, and I came to call this placeless seeming thing. And it, you know, it's really profound. Like, studies have been made, for example, people who live in what we call sprawl don't actually usually have a sense of the whole. What they have is a sense of their private routes through it, where they usually go. And you know, I used to say FedEx and UPS were probably the only people who actually had a sort of overview. Now they got GPS, they don't really even have to have that. Because, and I noticed that when you use GPS, you don't get that. You know, it's urban, but this kind of landscape, maps don't work very well. So I call it Atopia. And Atopia is topia being from topography, being a kind of place that is not a place, and or is not a place as we have known it, and isn't connected to the old things of topography, geography, and climate change. So I will stop there and pass over to you.
Well, I think it's time to pass it on to the audience, because someone may, we could talk all night, you know, and I don't think we could really have a, we sort of tried to have a fierce debate, but they're really, we are on the same page, I think, in so many ways, and I just want to say that Suki has done us all a great favor by talking about this thing that she calls Atopia. So let's see if we have any questions from the audience. Oh, Leonard.
Hi, I'd like to ask you, Betsy, you started the Central Park Conservancy. Tell us how that worked in terms of urban improvement.
Well, remember that when I read you just a little bit about William Cullen Bryant and Andrew Jackson Downing, how of course, I go back to Central Park always as an example, but that was started by citizen effort, and the Central Park Conservancy is, I'm very proud actually to say, it's the first public-private park partnership, and I am proud also I coined the word conservancy in relationship to park preservation. We have the Nature Conservancy, but it's the first time that word conservancy was used in this way, because actually it was a New York Times reporter that I was taking around the park in the very beginning when we were trying to create this organization in 1980. And she said, well, you mean you think of these things, these statues and everything like a museum? And I said, yes, you know, thinking that you have conservators, we are conserving, you know, Central Park as a great, great work of art. So, as I say, that was the origin, really, of the organization and of the word, and there are now, I don't know, 35, 40 conservancies in other cities throughout the country. Any other questions?
Thank you so much, both of you. It was absolutely fascinating to me, very stimulating. One thing that I was thinking about was, what is the effect of this mass tourism that we have everywhere on the sense of place? It is such a huge, you talk about, you know, the technology, but is New York City full of, you know, global tourists, the same New York City as it was when it was just full of New Yorkers and would-be New Yorkers? I mean, then, you know, as you, Suki knows, I now have a house in a place called Whitby in England, which was a great, very famous site, a ruined abbey on the cliff, and it's become incredibly famous as the place where Bram Stoker wrote Dracula. So that now, poor old St. Hilda, at the beginning of Christianity, has no place beside, you know, the gods and the dragons. But, you know, you talk about somehow all this being in the eye of the beholder. You know, people don't go places. Well, why do they go places? You know, what is it that draws them to places? And what do they see, and how does it affect us, you know, who have lived here for a long time? You know, so, but thank you so much.
One of the first things I noticed is with this thing of places not being quite what they seem was actually a sort of touristic thing, where the main fishing village really wasn't a fishing village, but it was maintained as one. Really, it's a real economy was attracting people to see a main village. It's a much commented on thing, that theme idea. But it is also true that places have become amenities. Like, it, because they're not important economically, actually, what's there, it's the amenity as tourists, as something to come see. Cities are really amenities now. If they're successful, it's because of the lifestyle. It's because it has a certain atmosphere that people want to come visit. It's not because they're an economic engine. Not true of New York, which is a sort of engine of global capitalism. It really does have an engine inside itself. But I think that's profound, and I think it's also very hard to travel now for the same reason, and feel that that you've seen something. It's hard to travel. I don't know why that is. It's actually, in some ways, more interesting to stay home and try to figure out what home is.
We mentioned water crisis. There's chain chambers, and there is now. The kids who grew up in the suburbs, they've rediscovered the city.
Yeah.
Susanna,
would you address what kind of a place is Hudson Yards?
She's asking, what kind of a place is Hudson Yards?
Oh!
I would say this, that this age, because it's not physical, actually hasn't manifested physically that much. And this city, which is a sort of command center of global capitalism, to use Saskia Sassy's term, remained much as it had been. We are now seeing, finally, a physical representation of that. Eventually, it's showing up. And that scale, that's a new scale. Yeah. That is not... The World Trade Center actually was the new... This all started really back in the 70s. It's a completely new scale. The other thing is, it's got nothing new to offer. It's got these franchises. That's essentially what's there. And I think it's important. The other thing we're seeing are these very high residential towers going up that are there for people to use for 2 weeks out of a year. They're going to be mostly there for the globe-trotting billionaires of the global economy, which means, I mean, this is the signature of our skyline. Is that? Now, that's a kind of, we can be horrified by that, but it is what is. I mean, what I say, you have to sort of go past your horror and try to get what in heck does that mean? It's, we're only now beginning to see it.
Well, I think we need another question, but I think it's money. I think it's money laundering.
I live in Barcelona, where we're trying to forgive tourists, one of the things I've seen, and I thought I'd put it in to this discussion, is that cities, what tourists do is they demand their image of the city be fulfilled. Now, we do not have indigenous paella in Barcelona, but we now have. We do not have flamenco. Flamenco is not a product of Barcelona. We now have really bad flamenco. And I'm just putting this information into the argument.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask Ty about the probably going back to the romantic idea of ruin and how that occurs in the landscape. Can you address contemporary ruin, like deserted shopping malls, giant waste sites, and how the contemporary ruin site
She's talking about contemporary ruins like abandoned shopping malls, the ruins of Atopia. It's a really fascinating idea. I found when I was doing it that it's so slippery. Atopia is so slippery. It's so hard to figure out where you are, even see it. It's hard to write about. I am really good at writing about place. Try to write about inside of a shopping mall. It's really hard. You can't get it. Yeah. If I get a deserted shopping mall, I've got something I can write about. So in a certain way, it's where it breaks open in those desolate kinds of places that I can get a hold of it better. I had to get places where there was some history and layering of landscapes before I could really write about it. You go to what's called edge cities, these sort of things like La Défense is actually that. These collections of business, corporate business, international business out in the middle of nowhere. And first of all, you can't find them. They're really far apart. They aren't really a place. You can't even find a perspective on it, like to begin to say, what is this? So the abandonment, while representing the terrible wastefulness of growth and this endless outward movement, leaving behind infrastructure that we're not using, is a problem of our way of growth. And Oregon, for example, put urban growth boundaries around, asked all municipalities to have urban growth boundaries. Didn't 20 years, didn't say where it had to be, but you had to do it. Portland hasn't had a new mall built outside that boundary since for 25 years or something. So there actually is a very simple solution to that.
No, you got hungry when you were in the mall and you had to have some ice cream and sit by the nice fountain with some landscaping around. I mean, produce a over there, and then we will have to stop.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hi.
You.
Me.
And speak up really loud.
I this is not a huge
we need a microphone.
I can speak up very loudly.
Okay.
I'm related to Sugi, so I can speak loudly. I'm wondering, this is a fairly basic question, what was the place that surprised you the most where you felt a very visceral connection and you had not expected to feel any connection in your landscape?
Yes. I do actually have an answer to that.
Okay.
Would you
repeat the question?
The question is, what place, tell me if I got it right, what place did I unexpectedly find a visual connection? Is that
a
right?
Visual connection of place to a place you may not have any connection to or memory of?
Unexpectedly, that's the good thing about the question. Well, actually, the place, the part that comes to mind, it was in a wrecked slave cabin in Louisiana. I'd gone out looking for, they're disappearing now. They were sharecroppers' cabins after they were slave cabins. And I did a whole thing in Natchez and a whole thing about the Annie Bellin Mansion and how we curated and how our new preservation has to do something rather different. And I wanted to see those, and I went over there and find them, and some young guy from Iowa had taken over the plantation. He wasn't there, and the jungly growths of trees, and then the cotton fields out there, and then I saw that inside these little mounds of trees there was something, and it was these wrecks, and I climbed into the wreck of a slave cabin, which had been a sharecropper's cottage and then was just sort of occupied by kids. You could see there was the Bud Club or something. And it was just a place. It was just, I expected some big marble thing or something. It was a sunspot on the floor. There was a window. It was quiet. And there's just that eternal thing. We find about a place. We find about a home. There are no words for it. You just say, what's that?
I think we've got to wrap up, but another one is Truth and Consequences, and that cabin, too.
Oh, yeah.
That's another very revelatory description of your book. Okay.
Well, I hope you'll all find it.